I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. A new book, the debut novel of Sarah Louise Butler, The Wild Heavens, has just been released. A former seminarian's lifelong obsession with a large set of tracks, footprints he sees in the woods, is at the heart of the book that looks at the scientific and the supernatural. I'll get Ms. Butler to tell us more about her book, about the intersection of imagination and fact. I'll also ask her about the wild and winter. Sarah Louise Butler's short fiction has been published in Room magazine. She has a degree in earth sciences and volunteer experience in wildlife research. This is her debut novel, and it is published by Douglas and McIntyre. She joined me from Nelson, British Columbia, just over a month ago. Please welcome to the Plante on the Line program, Sarah Louise Butler. Ms. Butler, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me on your show.
Thanks for joining us. What is it about the we were just talking before we started about the outdoors. I grew up in Vancouver, and unfortunately, it's a city, and so I'm not used to being outdoors as much as one should. One would assume, living in Nelson, that because it's a smaller town, if you will, that one is outdoors more. Is that a correct assumption on my part, say?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, if you, I've flown over this area before, and it looks like just a tiny little cluster of houses. It's actually a town of about 10,000 people, mm-hmm. but from above, you really see that it's just this little outpost surrounded by mountains in all directions.
And did you grow up in that part of the world?
No, I grew up, I did grow up rural, though, so definitely spent a lot of time outdoors. I grew up in South Central Ontario in a rural sort of agricultural area.
Mm-hmm.
At a time when, if it was a summer day and one of the kids went indoors, we better have a medical emergency to justify that, because it was just expected that we'd be outdoors from dawn till dusk all year round, mm-hmm. more or less. Yeah.
See, that's the thing, I guess, about growing up in the city. My first inclination, or I guess the inclination of a lot of people, is to sort of tame the outdoors, to because I guess we don't understand it. That's the only way we can, is to control it or try to know it as best as we can. The wild, I guess, brings out the worst impulses in us, is what I'm thinking.
Well, and I think that's also true for rural people in some extent too, because certainly farming and everything we do impacts. There's very little. I don't know that I've ever been anywhere that I could truly call wild. I always think of the term wild-ish to describe places that feel kind of wild. But then, I look down and I'm on a footpath that's been there for hundreds of years. So,
right.
Wild isn't maybe, I think that's probably pretty hard to find, although probably way up north there's more of it. And I've certainly, the further I've gotten from big settlements, the more it feels wild. There's just a different feel to it, and it's hard to it's a hard thing to put your finger on, but it does seem to get increased with distance from lots of humans.
So from what I've read of your book, The Wild Heavens, the first chapter at least, it is just remarkable in terms of what it evokes in me as a reader. I mean, I feel cold as I'm reading it. And where does the book take place?
Well, so it takes place in a fictional area. I didn't worry too much about the actual towns and cities. Those mm-hmm. are all made up. I mean, I have it set in B.C. There's sort of reference to a lower mainland that's, cities, so mm-hmm. that part's true. But in terms of the actual, sort of the urban geography of the book, totally fictional. But the main setting of this book, of course, is more the natural setting. And so the forests around here almost look coastal. It's wet. There's a lot of big cedars, lots of stuff covered in moss. Huckleberries, so that is more the real setting of the book, more so than any of the, the human-built stuff around it. So it's set in, for the most part, in a fairly remote little pocket of that sort of interior cedar hemlock mountainous forest.
And it's a place that in 100 years hasn't changed that much physically, is it?
Well, yeah, there's pockets that haven't, there's mm-hmm. a lot of cedar is really valuable, so it tends to get plucked out even when the rest of it's sort of undisturbed. So it's getting harder to find those sort of patches around here.
Uh-huh.
Certainly on the coast, there's probably more. But, for me, there's something about that kind of forest. I didn't have that growing up at all. There's nothing something like that. And for me, there was something really compelling about it. And for some reason, I kept coming back to this feeling that it felt magical. And I'm not someone who normally goes about using terms like that.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I wouldn't say it out loud, but I felt it every time when I first, you know, I've been here almost 20 years now. And slowly I started to realize that I think what was happening is that, you know, I was a little kid. I read lots of fairy tales. There was always the deep, dark woods. And I felt like it was only through writing this book I realized, I think that I'm relating this to the deep, dark woods. It's like, here I am in that fairy tale place, the deep, dark woods. And, of course, it's a perfectly real location. It's a real geographic region. There's nothing fairy tale about it. But I think for me, that was maybe part of the reason why there was just something really compelling about these forests for me personally.
So I read in your bio that you have a degree in earth sciences. And so one wonders then if, I mean, you just mentioned a moment ago that you never really thought of magic or the spiritual, if you will, in that sense, if you, but in the book, Aidan Fitzpatrick encounters this creature. And so if you're writing about this the way you have in The Wild Heavens, I mean, some people might wonder, you know, how do you reconcile the sort of scientific background that you've studied in with the mystery of that which you write about in your novel?
You pretty much called it. That was exactly the sort of dichotomy that I was sort of trying to reconcile or reckon with throughout the whole writing of the book, because for me, I shouldn't say I never used the terms like magical, because I actually grew up in a pretty devout Roman Catholic family.
Uh-huh.
And so my earliest influences were, there was the natural on the one hand, because we were rural and I spent a lot of time outside, and I was that kid who'd drag home buckets of swamp water and watch the mosquito larva hatch until someone caught me and dumped it out, or, you know, I always was really, really fascinated by wildlife. And so that was one really strong influence. And I felt a certain way when I was out sort of just quietly watching things on my own. And then at the same time, I had a feeling that at one age, really, really young age, felt similar to me, which was being in church on one of the big Catholic holidays, like Easter or Christmas or something. And I remember really, really believing. And so... yeah, trying to bring those two together, and then I left the church at a fairly young age, and so I guess with Aidan Fitzpatrick, I wanted to sort of play that out, but up the stakes. So rather than being an 11-year-old girl, he's, you know, a young seminarian who's soon to become a priest, and rather than sort of just becoming gradually disillusioned with the whole thing, I wanted him to have this tremendous faith, and I wanted him to lose it all at once.
Yeah.
I didn't want it to be gradual. Like, I just wanted, and then I thought, of course, like, what would that take? Like, that's, you know, it was quite a while, and it actually took sort of an interesting chance encounter around here before I realized what might be sort of drastic enough to precipitate that loss for him.
Yeah. So he sees something, and this obviously changes what he thinks. And, I mean, he leaves the seminary early in the book. What was his faith before that moment, say?
Well, so, I mean, it's common in Irish Catholic families, and even more so back then, but certainly still when my parents were growing up, that if, you know, if there's a big family with lots of boys, well, one of them was to become a priest. It was just sort of, I don't know if it was status or just custom or what, but it was sort of, it was just a thing. So he was that son in his family, and so he was on his path to becoming a priest. I think he would have been maybe in his early 20s at that age, so not super, super young, but still quite a young man, and really, really devout. And also, though, I didn't get, you know, most of his backstory didn't end up making it into the book, but definitely I wanted to have him someone who was already really interested in, like, sort of a naturalist, in the way that it seemed like a lot of sort of, you know, European background Christian dudes were at that time.
Yeah.
And so I wanted him to have that as well, because I wanted him to have some sort of concept for what he was seeing and not just think, oh, that must be a bear track. You know, he needed to have some knowledge in order to have that sort of the shock that he did at seeing what he did there. So,
So we've talked about this dichotomy of say, you know, the science versus the spiritual, the supernatural, if you will. I've always wondered about the supernatural in terms of why people buy into that. Does it fill the void for religion, say?
Well, it's really interesting thing, and it's something I think about a lot. I definitely don't have any answers for that, but I do find it really intriguing, just sort of, you know, most of us consider ourselves very rational, and we think that we make decisions in a rational way, and certainly we're capable, but, you know, when you look at humanity as a whole, it's pretty clear that we're not making very rational decisions a lot of the time, that it's much more instinctive, and I just find it really interesting, you know, like the human mind, it's like, you know, it's not a court of law, like we don't necessarily only believe what can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and also too, I sometimes wonder about like how much control we have as individuals over what we believe, like how much do we believe what we were told, and how much do we believe sort of, you know, the worldview that we grew up in, and how much choice is there in that, and I find it really interesting, and for me, the whole thing with the sort of superstition and magic, that kind of worked in with this book for me because, I was thinking of my really early years, and I remember believing, like, okay, there's fairies, there's giants, there's Jesus, Luke Skywalker is real, for sure, and then there's Hansel and Gretel, and, you know, those deep dark woods, Little Red Riding Hood, and I remember there was just this jumble, and then realizing, like, slowly sort of shockingly realizing that I was expected to outgrow some of those, but not others. And, you know, the adults around me, they had their ideas of which were to be outgrown and which were to be kept. And, it was not even a coming of age, I was too young for that, but just definitely a realization that I was like, wait a minute, I don't actually think I believe any of it. Like, I was a pretty science-minded kid, and I observed things, and the idea of evidence was really compelling to me. I really liked that, and so I kind of just walked away from all of it altogether, you know, not just the fiery tales, but the religion as well. Like a pretty young age, but I find it interesting how often people do leave the faith they're born in nowadays, and also that it doesn't seem like something that we talk about very much.
No, and then we fill that void with other things, you know what I mean? We fill it with belief in, you know, people read horoscopes and buy
exactly,
into that.
Exactly, yeah, that's the one that comes to me, too. I wondered if the rise of popularity of that sort of coincided with leaving organized religion, or just what that means. And, for myself, I'm a skeptic, you know. I heard it said once that anyone who's left the Catholic Church becomes a lifelong skeptic, and I think there may be something to that, you know.
Yeah.
And so, personally, I wouldn't have written about any sort of possibly semi-mythical creature if I hadn't spoken to someone who I do believe saw evidence of one.
Yeah, and there are a lot of people who have, you know, call it what you will, Sasquatch, Yeti, Bigfoot, who've seen this. I mean, I interviewed a guy recently who wrote a book about, there are scientific people who've looked into this and who buy into this, who believe this.
Yeah.
And so what is Aidan Fitzpatrick, what is he contending with throughout the book in terms of what he saw?
Well, I think, so initially, it started out, because I met someone who saw something similar to what he did at the very beginning, but only tracks. I met an old guy who lives a couple hours north of here, and he'd grown up really, really isolated. Like, although he'd grown up in B.C., he actually spoke with a faint Swedish accent that he picked up from his immigrant parents, because he just grew up that isolated from any other communities, and it would have been in maybe the 60s or 70s, so he was middle-aged at that time, and one night his neighbor comes pounding on his cabin door. It's like, he opens the door, and the guy's pale and shaking, and these are both, like, you know, woodsmen, like, they're not easily rattled. And he's like, oh, what is it? Is it a bear? Is he all right? Like, he's like, no, you need to come with me. You need to see this. And so the two of them trekked partway up the mountain along the creek bed, and then there's a spot where the creek kind of widened out, and there's mud on the sides, and they saw in the mud a really perfect, clear just one track, looked like a human had walked out barefoot, but massive, like way too big to be a person. And so I heard that story probably 10 years ago, or no, couldn't have been quite, maybe 7 or 8. I had just started, I wasn't very far along in writing this book. And then when I heard that, all of a sudden, I was like, okay, that's the piece, because I realized that sort of despite myself and wanting to initially write something quite scientific and rational, there was some sort of magic or something that almost wanted to creep into the story. I think it was that sort of early religious phase of my life that was coming up, and mm-hmm. I knew I wanted something, but nothing not overtly religious. And so I think, yeah, there's something about just the idea. I mean, there's something about the idea of just sort of an endemic, non-human, unknown primate that I wasn't one of those people. Like, I heard that interview, actually, with the nonfiction writer John Zeta, is it?
Right, yeah.
I just read that book, actually, too, and it was really, really interesting to me how sort of his conclusions near the end of how he sort of took the idea of the creature and sort of the symbolism of it and the metaphor, and I found that really interesting because I really agreed with pretty much everything he had to say about that, too, that...
Yeah. It's a thing that I haven't, you know, because I said at the outset, I mean, I never grew up in the outdoors. So, I can see that if you don't understand it, you might fill it with, you know, myths or you know, even mystery that makes sense, that there would be something there other than people. And so...
Yeah, Yeah.
Yeah. So I just figured, you know, that if that's what people think, well, then so be it. But I mean, again, living in the city, I'm looking for evidence. I'm looking for pictures, right?
Yeah.
And not just of tracks.
Yeah. Yeah. I know it's an interesting one, and I don't know how I'd weigh in on the actual, like, is this a real? You know, that's
sure.
Beyond my scope, but the idea of it I found really interesting, and also just when I started to poke around a bit that. There is something, like, I don't know about universal, but maybe almost culturally universal about the idea of sort of a wild form of human
mm-hmm.
out there. And I think, and some are overtly mythical, you know, and some, like, there's a European, there's a wild man figure that I don't think you're meant to believe in literally.
Yeah.
Understanding that it more represents, like, a wilder side of humans or a former side of humans. And I just, yeah, it is interesting. And for me, yeah, it wasn't an interest that was there for me until I met that old guy.
Yeah.
A couple hours from here, but then I was like, okay, that's interesting, and also, it was just something that I thought would fit well with what I was doing, too.
Yeah, and it's beautifully evoked in the book, or from what I've read so far, it allows us to contend with these things, and what we also think, another character we meet is Sandy Kingsley. What's she like?
So she is more, well, when we first meet her, she's a child, and she's pretty solid, clear-headed, not a very fanciful sort of child at all.
Mm-hmm.
And she's fairly isolated and quite observant. So she is noticing things and grappling with a lot of things. And her sort of lens of how she's interpreting her own experiences and what's happening is sort of based on what she's seeing around her, you know? So... You know, when she's, like, approaching puberty and she's starting to look around and check people out, and then she's thinking about, you know, okay, well, in deer, there's sexual selection, and then, wait, in the birds, and, like, those birds are bright-colored, and then the other one is dull, and she's sort of looking at everything through that lens, which I feel like I've always found that kind of an interesting thing, like, just the... It always jumps out at me when people say humans and animals, because... It's always been, from a really early age, like I wasn't just out looking at nature, I was reading and watching documentaries and all that, and I understood from a young age that humans are animals, like we are what we are, but we're certainly animals, and so, I really wanted to bring that sort of lens, and I had a lot of fun with that through writing it too, just the different ways that a person growing up and living, especially in a sort of rural place, could use what's going on around them to reflect their own experiences, and that part that was really fun to get into that in a lot of different ways.
So she's Aiden's granddaughter, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and there's at the end of the first chapter, she asks herself if she would have I've been born, had this incident with Aiden early on not happened. And I find that I'm still thinking about that in terms of, you know, our origin story, if you will, to borrow that phrase. How things can change on a dime, if you will.
Absolutely, because it's true, right? That really is. I mean, for a lot of people, it's more mundane, like had their parents not happened to me, for example, you know,
right.
Like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it, right?
And so this is something that I guess she has to contend with throughout the book, is that right?
Yeah, and I mean, there's that initial, like, you know, just that she was born of a loss of faith, in a way, you know?
Yeah.
And maybe in some ways that's true for a lot of people, but I just wanted it to be really overt in her case, you know. And then also, again, it's just that idea of belief and how the trajectory of it, and how, you know, had I stayed Catholic and grown up in the church, my life would quite certainly have gone really differently. And then, you know, maybe I would have been raising my son Catholic, and he'd be going to the Catholic school, and just there'd be this whole other, you know, beliefs really can, like, taking on a belief or losing a belief really can change the trajectory of not only our own lives, but the ones that come after. So, it's just something that's always interested in me a lot, and that I really wanted to sort of play with, not so much in terms of coming to conclusions, but just sort of really play around with in a lot of different ways in writing this book.
You know, when I talk to Catholics, because I grew up a Catholic, and I still think of myself as a Catholic, I find it fascinating because I realize now that I wasn't as Catholic as I should be. Or because I remember at an early age, I stopped going to catechism,
mm-hmm.
or Sunday school for people listening to us, because I found it tedious, or I just didn't like it, you know. And that upset my mother, who thought that... you know, I should, you know, because we're Filipino, so we have to grow up Catholic, I guess.
Yeah.
Even to this, I'm not confirmed. And, you know, she brings that up from time to time. I'm 37, and so I'm still hearing it. You know, she brings up things like, well, you'll never be able to get married or have a funeral in the church. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm not really thinking about those things even now.
Yeah.
You know, I did, when I stopped going to Mass, if I'm out of town somewhere, like when I was in New York City recently, I'd go to St. Patrick's Cathedral,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, sit in a Mass, if you will. But, I mean, I don't do that here in Vancouver, because there's other things I'd rather do on a Sunday morning.
Mm-hmm.
But I still, I mean, if you asked me, you know, what my religion was, I'd say it was a Catholic. And I think that's an interesting thing I mean, this is something that you had to contend with, did you?
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because it wasn't until a lot later that I realized that, okay, I might not be Catholic, but I'm still culturally Irish Catholic.
Uh-huh.
You know, like the expressions I use.
Sure,
the fact,
yeah.
You know, both of my brothers make beer. Like, there's just a lot of cultural things that I didn't, you know, of course, you take for granted, right, your own traditions. And so, yeah, that was really actually fairly recently that I was like, wait a minute, okay, yeah, I haven't thought of myself as Catholic since I was a child, but, yeah, I'm still, there's still that, my cultural background is definitely Irish Catholic, and so, yeah, it's kind of interesting, too, and that just made me think even more of it, like, well, what, you know, what do we leave behind, and what do we believe,
yeah.
and, you know, it's common, within my extended family, there's the full range, there's people who haven't been to church, like me, since they were quite
uh-huh.
young, and then there's others who are more and less devout, and who go to, you know, go to church here and there, but aren't particularly devout, but my family was one of the more, like, I wasn't actually an altar server, so right around when I was, you know, 9 or 10, in the parish where we live, they were starting to let girls do that, and of course not everywhere allowed
yeah.
that, it was mostly boys, but they were just starting to let some girls do it when I was about the appropriate age, and they pretty quickly realized that the girls tended to behave ourselves a little better up there,
right,
and
right. Yeah,
on average, so pretty soon it was, you know, myself and a handful of my friends who would be getting, you know, we could be out playing in the summer, and we'd get a call, oh, there's a wedding, need a couple kids to come down and serve, and we'd go, you know, put on the little white robe and the wooden cross around the neck, and I'd go stand there and hold the big heavy book and try to turn the pages of the. It was reminded me of turning the pages for my mom while she played piano, like trying to get it at just the moment, you know, and learning to read upside down. And I mean, my dad had been an altar server at a time when Mass was still in Latin. He actually studied Latin later in university, and my whole childhood there was this, even when I wasn't going to church, there was always this undertone of Latin where, you know, he'd say, oh, Dad, what's this word? He's like, oh, well, you know, that's from the Latin. Like, it was definitely, and then when I went to, you know, started studying science in later high school and university, it was a really interesting revelation to be like, wait a minute, this is all Latin.
Yeah.
Like, the species names, it's all Latin. And just that overlap, I don't know much of it myself, but I just found that interesting, and I wanted that for Aidan Fitzpatrick as well, because I thought that would kind of be a neat thing. Like, he leaves one thing behind, finds something else, but there's this common language through it, because, I've always found that kind of neat, too.
And because it comes at an early age, you don't shake it off as easily as, say, something, like if you tried to learn something today.
Yeah, and I mean, because it's sort of the underpinning of so much of English, too, and lots of other languages, so it's sort of there, you know? Like, even now, if I'm looking up a bird, or I'm looking up a plant I haven't seen before, often the Latin name, I'll be like, oh, of course, that makes sense, you know? I find that kind of neat, too.
And you ace all those questions whenever Latin comes up on Jeopardy or something like that, right?
Well, my dad did, that's for sure.
Yeah,
we always used to tell him he should go on one of those game shows. It would have been helpful.
Is The Wild Heavens, is this a book where you have the setting first?
Partly out of practicality, because, you know, I started the book, I had a single mom with a 4-year-old, and I didn't have the means or time to travel at all, really, and so it had to be set in immediately accessible areas. But also because I did move here as an adult, there was just a lot. I just found this area so interesting, and so, like, not Nelson per se, Nelson's not in the book, but just sort of this general, you know, damp cedar forested and mountains, you know, mountains. I hadn't grown up with those, so it adds a whole different, it adds another dimension to life, I think, having that being in mountains. So, yeah, the setting is really, was huge, for sure, and, like, almost a character of the book in a way, and that was really, for me, I think, because I wrote the book really slowly and in little stolen chunks of time, so it felt like I was going to a place, like more than doing a thing. It felt, the book kind of felt like a place I was going, and so I thought, well, if I'm going to finish this, I better make it a place that I really love and really want to be. And so, I think that probably came through, and just that I really do love that particular type of place.
Are these characters that you love?
Yeah, well, I kind of had to, and also this is a pretty small cast of characters, partly because I thought, it's my first book. I learned on the job to some extent. I'd written some short stories, but, I wanted to keep it sort of manageable in that sense, you know, like I wanted to, the challenges for myself writing, I wanted to be more the philosophical underpinnings and sort of the, you know, pulling things together over time, but I didn't want to be challenged trying to keep track of a whole bunch of different characters, I deliberately kept that quite small. I get confused sometimes in books that I'll really love them, but if there's too many characters, I'm like, wait, who is that? Like, I find it, that's maybe just me, that I get distracted sometimes, so I really wanted to keep it really small and really clear, and sort of mostly sort of within a family or a small group of people.
That's the other thing, because there aren't many characters in the book. Even early on, I found the isolation of it all. I felt that acutely, and I don't know. I guess it's just growing up in a city where I'm surrounded by people. That heightened whatever I was feeling about this place that you're writing about.
And it sort of needed to be, for me to plausibly have, you know, some of the wildlife encounters she has, it needed to be kind of remote, you know, there's something, I found that sense of isolation, it just sort of, it amps things up to some extent, you know, if funny because when I go to a city, I feel really overwhelmed with all the people. Like
I'll bet, yeah.
It feels like going to the circus. Like, it's
sure,
really cool
yeah.
and fun to visit people, but at the end of the day, I'm exhausted. Like, I feel really worn out by the traffic and the people. And
the noise.
I haven't really lived in cities much at all. Like, I went to university in a small city in Ontario, but, you know, that's different on campus all the time. And, yeah, it's not something I've done a lot of, and I think, yeah, the rural stories are interesting, too. We don't get to hear them as much. Like, actually, I was reading, which is on the Alexis' latest, Days by Moonlight.
I was reading
last summer, and I came upon, it's set in southern Ontario, and I came upon this reference, and I got super excited and took a picture of it and sent it to all my siblings because he refers to a little tavern in, I mean, Peterborough, Ontario. It's not a tiny place, but it's close to where we grew up, and we just don't come upon, growing up where I did and living mostly in rural places, you don't come upon references to places that you know and are familiar with in terms of cities, you know? Like when I read a book about New York City or Paris or even where I don't know these places, they're not, it doesn't take away from the reading of the book, but it sure is exciting to, when it's not normally your experience, to come upon a reference to something that you're like, oh, I know that thing. Like that's, I've been there or I've been in a place like that. And so for me, setting it in the same sorts of forests and mountains that I spend so much time, it felt that way for me. I'm like, okay, here's that lichen I always see. I'm putting that in. And it's almost like someone from a city might put in a landmark church or a courthouse or something, you know. Just the familiar little details around you are quite different in a rural place than they are in a city.
As people nowadays say, you know, representation matters, doesn't it?
Taking that into a non-human realm here.
But it's such a delight, you know, when you see, even if you're watching a movie, for example, and you see, you know, because they film a lot of this stuff here in Vancouver, to see the place. I mean, you know, people still get excited, or they, you know, these websites here in Vancouver write about these things.
Yeah, well, and it does. It obviously speaks to something in us, because we get excited.
Yeah. So this is the first novel. I hate asking this question when I interview authors, but, I mean, are you working on something else now?
I'm really, really preliminary working on, I am. Something set, a completely different setting. I feel like I've tapped out all my ideas for this sort of place. And also, too, I didn't really get into a lot of, you know, my own actual childhood is not really in this story much at all.
Uh-huh.
And so there's that whole sort of rural, free range, like I've already told all my siblings that I'd like them to start, you know, telling me some of their childhood stories. Like we all had, you know, slightly different experiences growing up, but just that rural, free range sort of the fields and the farms and all that. So I think definitely the setting I've got, and not a few other little things, but nothing really very set in stone yet.
So you've published short fiction before. This is the first novel. Was it much of a leap in terms of how you wrote? Was it different writing this than, say, the other?
Yeah, it really was. A short story I could keep in my head. I could keep the whole thing in my head. I could picture the beginning and the end and the middle and then fill things in. And I don't think it would be accurate to say it's necessarily easier because it's just different, right?
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it was... Yeah, it was just sort of more manageable also given that I didn't have big stretches, still don't really have big stretches of time to just write or a lot of like quieter retreats or anything like that. I was writing initially in little chunks, and then my son got older and was in school full time, and you know, my schedule shifted around and I was able to work on it more. But I actually initially was thinking I would try to write more short stories, and then I don't know, all of a sudden I just wanted to go. I had written a short story actually with some of the characters in this book, with Sandy and her kids when they were teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a short story where those characters sort of came to be over 10 years ago now, and then I just sort of was revisiting them, and I wanted to go, I don't know if deeper is the right word, but I just wanted more space to play with some ideas that you needed almost a person's lifetime to tease out, rather than just the span of what I could fit in a short story.
Yeah. Sarah, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today. Congratulations on this book and good luck with it. I appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was really great speaking with you too.
The book is called The Wild Heavens. It is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Its author, Sarah Louise Butler, joined me on the line from Nelson, B.C. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.